What's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. Today I have Rob Estratino from Salmon Theory, the newsletter that many of you subscribe to, but also recently from Salmon Labs. So much salmon. Rob, you're now doing your own thing. Today we're going to talk about workshops because we are dropping a document called Stop Collaborating and Listen, which is absolutely a Vanilla Ice reference. Now, I don't know if people know the song. It starts with the Queen reference, right? Which is ding, 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 did a ding, ding.
Oh, yeah.
Collaborate and listen. But we went ding, 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 did a ding, ding. Stop collaborating and listen. Because Rob and I, forgive the language, we're workshop whores. I've run hundreds of them. And I just felt like a court jester in the US. So I decided to not do that anymore and to change my life. But we're going to talk about the 10 reasons that we feel workshops are forced on us. Before we get to that, Rob. Salmon Labs, your own venture. What are you learning a couple of months into running your own strategy-based consulting / company situation?
Well, the very first lesson is not to take calls from coffee shops, which I'm already breaking. It's something I had been cooking up. There's pun number one for a while. You can count these, by the way, how many puns I can squeeze in a single answer.
It's so boring to do that. I'm not a pun counter.
No, it's something I've been thinking about for a while because Salmon Theory has been around 6, almost 7 years. And, you know, I learned a lot through it. I built some sort of reputation through it. I know junior strategists read it. I know senior strategists read it. I know some clients read it. And it always felt to me like there was a lot of things I was exploring there that I wanted to put into practice. You know, essentially, my time at VCP came to an end relatively recently, 6 years, good run. And I just decided, okay, a time as good as any. Yeah, I've been consulting, been quite lucky, found a founding client. They've been absolutely great. Doing a lot of brand strategy work, integrated communications work, some of which will go live in summer. And I think the big lesson for me has been not only about the strategy I write, but the way of working around strategy, which is something I'm increasingly interested in because it just feels to me like there's a few issues, and workshops may be one of them, but it goes wider than that, around how strategists think they should work versus what clients expect their strategy teams to be able to do with them. So I've been a bit of a rabbit hole around the ways of working that don't rely on, for example, what I think is a bit of an old school notion of, oh yeah, I'll go in, fix it all for you. I just don't think a lot of businesses respond to that anymore, or at least it's not an effective way of doing things. So I actually proudly present incomplete work to my clients, and I call it a prototype. It's not a performance, it's a prototype. It's a little thing I've been toying with. And we do daily sprints, like the cool tech people do. And so far, feedback's been great. It's how I like to work because I get too self-conscious if I don't have frequent contact with others on the stuff I'm working on, to be honest with you. But it also keeps senior clients, it gives them a sense of they're aware of what's happening, how it's changing. And it feels like we're like co-conspiring towards the answer rather than I'm trying to impress them with my answers.
A nice set of like little epiphanies. I think when you start your own thing, you also get to ask what you were touching on just then, not just what does a client want from me and how can I work well with a client, but like, how do I work well?
Yeah.
Instead of sort of playing along with the playbook that you've grown up in, you can focus on maybe 5 moves from the playbook and say, that's really what I want to do. For some people, that is doing workshops, which we're not exactly going to crucify. Like, I like a workshop, it gave me a role, but we're going to poke a little finger in the eye of the workshop industrial complex. What's been the hardest thing about what you're doing now, this new phase of your life?
The hardest thing, I suppose, is you need to wear hats that, frankly, we're not trained to wear when you're a strategist, right? One of the luxuries of being a strategist is you don't need to worry about a lot of things like client politics, although I do believe you should to an extent. You don't need to think about business development, although I think we should to an extent. And you don't need to think about money, although I think we should to an extent. But now, I got no one to do these things for me. So I've been having to learn how to prospect without feeling like that guy, you know, like, hey, I can 10x your results if you reply to this LinkedIn message. You very quickly start needing to wear hats that for a while just feel a bit uncomfortable because I never felt comfortable selling things. But now if I don't do that, I sink. That's pun number two.
Is that an SYNCH or an SINK?
If you want to keep to the 90s reference, it's definitely an NYC, whatever the yeah, the Timberlake one.
And for anybody who's never heard two strategists talk to each other, this is what happens. Super awkward, Rob. Just awkward strategy conversations, am I right? Let's chat about workshops. So we got together and wondered to what degree could we collaborate, because I think I've written some stuff for you. You've done a couple of things for Sweathead talks and teaching and whatnot. And we thought, well, let's write a little thing together. We both like to write. What are we going to pick on? Workshops. Why did you want to write and think about workshops?
Because this is kind of the boring answer. They can be a great tool, but they can also be a blunt tool. And they can sometimes feel like a bit of theater, but not the good kind. It's almost like a bit of theater where half the cast isn't really interested in partaking.
Yeah.
It's like half of them are like, I don't really want to wear this suit. Why are you making me do this? That's a pretty shitty play we're watching right now.
I mentioned this moment in the introduction to this deck. And yes, we are promoting this deck, which is free for you to read. I'm going to put the link in the show notes. I don't do podcast chat very often, but we have show notes. I'll put the link in there. Let's talk about 10 reasons they force workshops on us. We have 10 here. The first one is, like, workshops are performances of democracy. Talk to me about that.
It's a performance of democracy in that, on the one hand, there's almost like this need to make everyone feel heard, which is in principle right. But then on the other hand, there's always someone that kind of has the final say. But what's weird is that this is never purely acknowledged. It's like, no, we can all have ideas, but my ideas are better. But no one ever acknowledges this. It's just that we call it a democracy, but then deep down someone's going, no, that's shit. Oh, this one thing I said, this is the answer. So that's my interpretation of when we talk about performance of democracy. It's like going, you all vote, but ultimately the government chooses who they want anyway.
Yeah, so it's sort of like a little bit of corporate gas. Especially if you're in countries where hierarchy is very implicit. So the US is actually quite hierarchical, but it has to act democratic in all interactions, even though there's research about how big decisions tend to not get made in a group, which we all know. But then you have to act like you're going to influence a decision. You're probably not. So it's, some workshops are just not honest. Number two, workshops can be acts of spite towards the creative team. Have you experienced this?
Yes, I have seen instances where we do a workshop to basically get the creative team to do stuff they are not used to doing.
Or that they're resisting,
right? You go, right, so this idea, for the 100th time, we can't afford TV, stop sending scripts. Okay, let's workshop. Let's do a workshop. Let's talk about other things and, see if 7 people telling a team what they should be doing is going to get them to do it, which you could argue sometimes you need a bit of that to kind of change people's ways, but it feels a bit spitey if you look at it from the outside.
And I'm sure if you study the room for micro expressions, there's always a little bit of an eye roll or a side glance towards the difficult people when they don't get TikTok or they don't get Reddit or they don't get email or whatever it is. It's like, oh, it's hilarious though. A revenge-tinged workshop is quite tasty. It's quite tasty.
It's very simple stuff just on the body language, but like, as soon as one of the creatives crosses their arms, you go, yeah, this isn't working, is it? Some of us really don't want to be here.
Number three, look, we all know this, especially if you've been fortunate enough to live in a nice city that people are excited to visit and your clients don't live in that city. Maybe they're in a business park in deep New Jersey, for example. But number three, workshops are a good way to block out chunks of the day.
So you talked about New Jersey. Our equivalent is like Slough versus London. For anyone who's watched The British Office, Slough is where the office is based. That's the energy of Slough. By the way, I've been to Slough. It's a nice place, but it's not sexy East London. And so sometimes it's just a good way to go, yeah, let's all sit here. We'll have the cool pastries. You know, we'll mingle along. We won't sing Kumbaya, but that's just about the only thing we won't do. And by the way, those things for relationship building are great, but sometimes a workshop just feels like, let's just carve out an afternoon to not have to answer email all day, which maybe is a good thing, but let's call it what it is.
The last job I had as head of strategy of an 800-person agency that did not want strategists, I think it was day one or two, I was invited to attend a 2-day workshop. And I got there and they said, can you run it? And I was like, yeah, I can run it because I'm workshop guy. Like, this is how much of a workshop guy I am. I will not say no, especially because the client was there. And I had to work out like what on earth we were doing. And like, how do you book this workshop for 2 days? There's 20 people here. How do you book it without having an agenda? And then the head of the business unit, so they're running, you know, 200 people of this 800 person thing, was just an asshole. This guy was in and out all day going, have we got anything yet? Over my shoulder in front of everyone. And I'm like, bro, I just started here. I know you don't want any of us here, like the strategists here. You don't want me here necessarily, but you don't need to like be a sociopath on day one for me, bro. Like, just relax, just relax. Number four reason is people believe workshops can make ideas cheaper.
For me, there's two sides to this, right? Workshops make ideas cheaper if you charge for time, because you basically go, hey, we got 2 hours and we whatever comes out of it is what we do. Which sometimes is good, but sometimes is not good. But the flip side of that is that if you don't charge for time, workshops can actually, in theory, make ideas profitable. Not necessarily good, but profitable, because you're not charging for the 2 or 3 hours you were there. You're charging for the value of what comes out of it. But a lot of the times it's just, yeah, we can't really afford the senior team to go away for 2 weeks. Let's just workshop it. Or sometimes, let's not even bring them in. This is the other side. Let's not even bring them in. Let's just have a go at territories and then tell them what to do.
No, territories, kill me now. Yeah, keep going.
Or provocations. For anyone who's new to strategy, every time a strategist says provocations, they're probably saying, I don't want to commit to an answer yet, but I don't want to look stupid.
A little bit of that, but also like Edward de Bono, who promoted the idea of lateral thinking, he used to talk a lot about Poe. Provocation as a really useful collaborative problem solving tool. It is useful. I don't mind it. If that's your whole personality, my whole personality is reggaeton, by the way. So people don't get to say like, hey, your whole personality is strategy posts on Instagram. But if that's your whole personality, provocations, and you're trying to weasel out of work, yeah, it's not a good look, but still useful. Territories, on the other hand, can be useful, but the way that people use them, so annoying. Like, you have really specific things on the wall and someone's like, aren't we really talking about empowerment of the human species? And you're like, no, we're talking about how guys feel when they lose their hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so annoying. And it's literally a game that some of the most senior people I've worked with, not in Australia, but in the US, they can play that game for 10 years and they get away with it, and their CCO and their president, and you're like, just stop it.
A former head of planning I worked with had this gag about a former CEO I used to work with. And he would always go, right, every time you involve this person in a workshop of some kind or a brand strategy discussion, you can put a timer on how quickly they go, are we really talking about carpe diem? Because it always ended up on that, because that was the one answer for them. But yeah, it's like we all have default modes. We go, it's like, oh yeah, it's all about empowerment. You go, oh my God. By the way, anytime anyone says it's all about something, you know it's not going to be very good. It's all about enablement. You go, oh.
I know, but what they're trying to do, I understand this better now because of YouTube and Fortnite and PUBG, is like they're trying to pretend that they understand the meta. Now, I know not everybody understands the cool language that I'm using, that the young people that I use. The meta is trying to understand the first principles of a game when it's released every season so that you can win it. So that, I don't know, certain pieces or characters or weapons do really, really well in season one, then it doesn't quite work in season two. You've got to change your whole strategy and tactics, right? So what that person's trying to do is like they're trying to understand the meta. And that person will often say, I don't even know what the number is. Well, there's only 7 kinds of story anyway. And it's like, so what? Write a good freaking story. I don't need that. That's like, it's so annoying. Number four, as far as workshops can make ideas cheaper, I'm okay with that a little bit. The biggest shift I think I've made in the past 10, 15 years as I got older is trying to be upfront about how workshops are not an endpoint. And if you want to use them, quote unquote, use them effectively, use them to help the core team that's working on the stuff gather stimulus and thoughts. Let them go away after everything's gathered for a few days, because this is how the brain works when it's actually being creative, to do what's called convergent thinking, which is not just extract, but to focus all the stuff that's all over the place into something that's really specific. But if you're just looking at workshops as a way to cheaply get through a day and get to an endpoint, I think you're selling all of us short.
And by the way, I mean, just on that, we're not saying workshops are inherently bad. It's just what you use them for. If you use them to basically tell the creative team implicitly or explicitly, we can probably get there faster than you could, even though you've worked on this for 25 years, then that's where it starts literally cheapening, because you can't charge more, you cannot charge more, and also cheapening the perceived value of a good idea and someone who knows what a good idea is.
Connected to that, number five, workshops can happen because people who encourage workshops don't necessarily understand creativity. And what we really mean by that is the psychology of creativity, the way that the brain needs stimulus and it needs to do something different. It needs to be distracted. At some point, a person or two need to find a singular voice for the idea and not have slides and things committed, not a word, right, into just a whole bunch of stuff that makes people feel that they've been recognized and happy. Important, but not in this particular situation. I think there's just generally, there's a lot of people working in quote unquote a creative industry that don't understand creativity and how the brain works and how people work. And it's, I don't know, you should have to have a license. I'm joking.
But there's definitely things that definitely stood the test of time, like that James Webb Young book about technique to produce ideas. One of the techniques is give it time. It's like microwave thinking versus oven roast thinking. Like, a juicy roast takes time. If you put a frozen chicken in the microwave, it will be horrible.
All right, number six, workshops can make projects happen faster is a belief that's out there that makes a lot of workshops happen. What's your response?
Part of me, when we thought about this, part of me was like, sometimes part of me really wants projects to work faster, which sometimes feels counterintuitive because you can argue that sometimes you don't spend enough time discussing the problem is and we just jump to, right, it's this thing. But it does feel like, on the one hand, speed can be interpreted as just do something, just do anything, so we can all close this work stream and do something else because none of us really want to be here. I do actually think sometimes projects happening faster is good, especially if you work with bigger brands. It's really hard to get everyone. Like, you'd think people who work cross-functional teams talk on a daily basis. They don't. It's when you get them together to do a workshop, whether they want to be there or not, that's probably the first time they're all talking in the same room in like 5 months. And so that can be a good thing. Project goes faster because you make some bloody decisions and you kind of move on. They're imposed sometimes because, whether it's the client imposing or the agency imposing, I think there's a need for speed, like the game.
I think they can make things happen faster, maybe better, maybe not. It depends who gets to own the output, right? Because if you're running a workshop and there's 30 people there, and then the owner of the idea is a creative team, the incentives are not aligned, because the creative team needs to have a moment of, that's my idea, and you've just broken the game. So that's where a lot of the friction can happen. And I get why people would be frustrated with both being forced into a workshop, but also having a workshop forced on them.
There's probably a bit of a correction there that, or an overcorrection that happens, which is, like, I've worked in integrated environments where, rightly or wrongly, sometimes what happens is you have 4 weeks to come up with something. The first 3 weeks are for coming up with the TV, and then the last week is to come up with everything else. So under those circumstances, I can understand where clients might go, I'm sorry, why'd you need 3 weeks for that first thing? And maybe you do, but then you overcorrect by going, no, let's workshop it and do it. So, like, each of these are on two sides of a scale, probably. But yeah, when it feels like the agency is taking too long or faffing around, even if they're not, but sometimes they are.
Well, that connects to number seven, right? The workshops can make people feel in control. So a pitch comes in, a short turnaround request comes in, let's just get together, which is a reaction that's probably more prominent in PR agencies, social agencies, digital agencies than in quote unquote more traditional TV-led agencies. But it still happens. Why do you think that workshops give people this sense of control? Sometimes false control, sometimes it's a waste of time. It would have been better for a person or two just to go away and think.
It's action bias, right? And by the way, when we spoke a few years ago, and I was actually freelancing back then, I talked a lot about the importance of momentum. And I think we all default to go, like, just get something on the table so that we can go from there. And I think actually that has merit, because the first rule of writing is get to your shitty draft as quickly as possible, because after that, it's not writing, it's editing. And you can rewrite it again and have a go again, but at least you have something to look at and to go, it's definitely not this. But I'm a big fan, and just going back to the first point on ways of working, I'm a big fan of getting to something very specific as fast as possible, because I'm actually looking for people going, oh, it's definitely not that. And you go, great, let's continue on the specifics. But until you get there, it's all just a bit fluffy and in the air. So yes, action bias can be a problem, but if that results in concrete things that you can either accept or reject or leave a little yellow sticky note, we'll get onto the sticky notes in a second, I'm sure, I think that can be useful. But yeah, sometimes it's just, to quote a quite prominent author, a lot of running, not a lot of playing.
But also just on the action bias, I think you're going to experience this if you haven't already, that when you run your own business, but you're also sort of selling your own thinking, you need both the hare and tortoise energy. Sometimes when you're panicking, sometimes the best thing to do is to not do much, to go for a walk, right? Especially when you're running your own business and consulting, as long as you've been active and people know about you, some of these things happen in seasons and cycles. And all of a sudden, a month that was dead is followed by a month where you have five people wanting to work with you like that, and then it can dry up again and then it pops up again, right? And so one of the sort of most prominent examples of tortoise energy for me was when I first started trying to work out what on earth I wanted to do in life. In my late 30s, I would go for very long walks around Central Park, and I would have to convince myself this is the best way to spend my time right now. And I didn't even have timesheets, but I was 20 years in timesheets almost by then, right? Started at the age of 20. So like, what am I going to put on timesheets if I had them? Still, that energy is still in me, but I guess that's also a level of conscientiousness that makes you keep working and produce when other people just turn off completely. So there's that. Number 8 reason they force workshops on us: workshops appease the ego.
We all want to be at the big boy and big girl table, and that makes us feel important. By the way, putting people around tables to talk is a good thing, but sometimes a workshop makes something that's not very big feel big. Maybe it's because it makes the agency feel a bit more self-important. Maybe it's because it makes the client feel more self-important. But we feel good workshopping things because it feels like we're having a big strategic discussion about some emails. By the way, love emails. I write a newsletter. I love emails, so don't get angry at me, customer engagement peeps. But
we're pro email. We're pro tables. We're pro conversations around tables. We're pro workshop, you know?
I am not pro sending emails while on the table. If you're on the table, don't send emails.
Dude, to promote your Salmon Labs, I have an idea. It's a calendar for 2025 where you're on a table dressed in one salmon and you know where it goes, and you're lying down sending emails, and every month it's a different salmon on a different table.
Do you think I can just use Dolly for that? Just do some Gen AI on it.
I was about to say I'd like to see that, but I would like you to see it because that's hilarious to me. I can see it for you, for your brand, mate.
It may be, and maybe, what are we thinking? Are they like mildly sexual in nature, or is this a sexy fireman calendar?
Yeah, but it's you sending emails, lying down on one side, and you have a salmon covering your front bits. Come on, mate. Better explain it to you. We should have workshopped this.
Look, all's fair in the game of standing out. So if Scott Galloway many years ago would do his L2 videos wearing a dress because that got him attention, I mean, he must be doing something right.
All I'm probably saying is at some point my next headshot might be me as a reggaeton artist. That's all I'm saying. But there's definitely a thing in your 40s and 50s where you start to do that stuff and then you're like, yeah, you don't need to do that. But it's definitely it's age related for sure.
I think we should workshop this with the Sweat Hat Group.
I'm going for hair that's like Cinco Corleone and what's his name? Peso Pluma, a little bit of some bangs. I don't have a mullet just yet, but anyway, just testing to see if you know who I'm talking about. Of course you don't, because you like Brazil funk because you're from Portugal. So the ego thing is number 8. Yeah, it's totally true, but I like it. It definitely pleases my ego a little bit when I get to be helping people, because, you know, a lot of us are people pleasers, helping people in public, in front of people, validation, love language, to overcompensate for maybe not feeling that in parts of life. Anyway, number 9. Workshops can lead to better ideas. So this is definitely an idea that's out there. It's not wrong or right, but there's this thought that we have to have a workshop because it will lead to a better idea. Reaction?
So what's great for workshops, if you do it well, is you just generate a lot of stuff. And I am a believer that if you have someone with judgment looking at all that stuff, then the quantity inevitably leads to some quality, right? Loads of people talk about this. The best way to get a good idea is to have loads of really crap ideas. So maybe there's an advantage to not everyone having good ideas. Let's just get all the crap ideas on the table and go, great, here's what to avoid. And by the way, this counters the ego thing. It's absolutely okay. Over the years, I've gotten more and more used to just saying dumb shit and not feeling personally threatened when people go, that's a bit dumb. And I go, yeah, I know. because it's like a chain of events. If I say something dumb to you about big booty salmon on a table sending emails, you might go, no, it's not salmon, but maybe it's this other thing. Like, my thing was dumb, but it sparked something less dumb. And so I think that dynamic in crowds can be quite powerful. And I know you drew from some research that happens on it, but it just makes intuitive sense. And you hear over and over again from like I was listening to an interview a while ago with the VP of creative at Liquid Death. And the way they measure good idea was when they go, that's so dumb, let's do it. But you only really get to the dumb shit if you have loads of people coming up with dumb shit together and you make it okay. So provided those circumstances are there, workshops can lead to better ideas. If there is a fear that someone will go, no, that's definitely not it, then they don't.
Yeah, it's having the looseness and encouraging a looseness of thought to generate a lot. But if people don't know what an idea is and they're not good at writing, and whoever's writing down the ideas just writes up, you know, do a tentpole activation at South by Southwest and do a partnership with Spotify, etc., then every workshop room looks like every workshop room. So you still need to understand the mechanics of ideas. You need to have a writer, you need to have a voice and quantity, you know, but just quantity is really an excuse to have sandwiches together. That's all I'm saying.
It's actually not too dissimilar to how you may or may not introduce LLMs into your process, where you go, I'm a big fan of Claude, the generative AI. I actually don't know a guy named Claude. Anyway, Claude and ChatGPT and stuff. I mostly say Claude because I want to sound hipster and everyone says ChatGPT. And I go, no, Anthropic is a bit better. But if you go there and you go, give me 100 ideas on how to sell, you know, trips to Mars to rich families, you'll give me 100 ideas. Maybe two of them are good, but the rest of them are a bit bad. So you can treat your relationship with an LLM in the same way you treat a workshop, in that volume is good, but eventually one of you needs to have judgment to go, I think this is kind of different and probably closer, not a territory, but probably closer to where we want to be. Because the LLM isn't going to do it for you, and a crowd isn't necessarily going to do it for you. So, like, going back to the analogies we sometimes use around writer's room and newsrooms and stuff, in a newsroom, everyone pitches articles, but the editor decides. That's how it works. And the editor needs to have judgment on, is this going to be interesting?
Also, with the newsroom and the writer's room, you're dealing with writers. They're full-time writers, okay? Full-time writers. Full-time writers who studied writing. They write all the time. They're pitching to an editor who's obviously very good at what they do. They have sub-editors around them. It's so not like for like. It's always amusing to me when someone sort of cherry-picks, which you're going to do with an analogy or metaphor.
Can you imagine if writers, full-time writers, all of a sudden go, let's just workshop some accounting together. See if we can turn this business. It's the same dynamic. It's like, we'll just do some spreadsheets together and try and turn around this business. You go, I don't think that's how it works, boss.
It's true, it's true. All right, number 10. I relate to this, though. 10th reason people force workshops on us, and maybe we've forced workshops on other people, is that workshops are seen as a smart new business tool.
They can be a great way of bringing in people who are not from the... I've seen this tons of times in my time at VCP, where we do workshops with one type of client, say a health client, and go, right, we're going to bring some of the other expertise, it's like domain expertise people from the group, to help think and shape how this campaign might play out from a customer experience level, from a social level, from a retail level, whatever. And so in that sense, they can be great to cross-sell other services without it feeling like, here's another giant deck on creds. They can also be good within the existing retainer, just like even sometimes they can be used to protect the budget that is there, because you're actually kind of, you know, if you're doing an ad campaign, you're basically keeping it all under your roof instead of it being like really disparate across three agencies. Because sometimes that happens, right? It's like, no, you do that thing and you do that thing and you only do the master ad. And someone goes, no, let's workshop it so we can all do it under the same roof. But fundamentally, from what I've observed, they're great at going, right, the core team, core brand team at the agency side is going to involve other people who can help with other parts and other problems in the business. And then, of course, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it shows the client a bit of what else you can do with us.
Yeah, it presents a smorgasbord of people that might be new to the client. They might feel they're in a silo of the agency. It can also potentially short circuit procurement processes, pitches, for example. I've heard a few stories, but I think they get a lot more attention than the reality of how often they're successful. But, you know, we're going to have a chemistry meeting and there was going to be this procurement thing, but we did a workshop and maybe we got paid for it, and then they canceled the pitch process because they loved working with us. You know, and workshops can also just be a way of showing that you're different from the other agencies. You listen, you're fast. You're not going to bog them down in, honestly, like too much process. A lot of people get frustrated with creative teams because of the perceived arrogance as well. So there's a lot of stuff going on there. Rob, how was it collaborating with me on this?
I kind of joke now that my entire life is built around the idea of building planes while I try and fly them and try and get people to not jump off and there's no terrorists on board. That's a very large, long-winded metaphor. It's funny, the more I think about it, I think we started by cooperating, and then maybe towards the end we got to collaborating a little bit more. And by cooperating, it took me a while to get my head around this, but you know, the distinction you made around cooperating is basically not getting in each other's way, and then collaborating is going, oh, let's build on this, let's build on that. It was a good meta exercise of going, how do you collaborate remotely and also a little bit in a coffee shop in London around something that we don't yet know what it is?
I think the cooperating phase and the collaboration phase is legitimate. I think a lot of creative partners do that, where they go away and they write and then they come back and see what the overlaps are. And maybe one person takes a strong voice and one person takes more of the visual angle. It's pretty common, because otherwise you can just get stuck when you're staring at each other. Like, who writes first? I don't want to offend you. I don't want to be too controlling and whatnot. So I think it was kind of a natural way that we ended up working together.
And there's the other side of it, which is there was a point where we realized, well, we probably need to give ourselves a deadline, and almost a purposefully aggressive one, so we can get it done with. Because the other part of collaboration is it can take forever, right? Let's keep collaborating. It's like, no. Collaboration is a way of getting to a deadline and doing something that hopefully is better than not collaborating. So if I recall correctly, we had a call on what, Friday or whatever? And we went, right, this needs to be done by Tuesday. And so we just went, B-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b-b. So that's the moment where collaboration time's over. It's get it fucking done all the time.
The final thing I'll add, maybe we talk about this in 5 or 10 years' time, is like, I know I'm talking about myself, by the way, but I'm doing that because I know people are going to be venturing into more of an independent life, which is what I've been trying to set up. So that's why I'm talking about it. I'm quite energy oriented. So if I get excited and we click and we work well together, it's done. If I feel that someone's retreating or they're being difficult or they're resisting, then I'm like, I could do something else. And literally my brain will just be like, I could either go to the gym right now, or I could write a thing on Instagram, or, you know, I could write a book or something. And so I'm quite energy oriented in a way where I remember working with, I'm sure she won't mind me saying this, the CEO of Poo-Pourri, which had a few big viral moments. I learned that from her. She's very spiritual. You know, one of their videos has had tens and tens of millions of views online. P-O-O-P-O-U-R-R. I think it's 2 R's. I, Poo-Pourri, the toilet spray. And it's not that she said something like you're in or out, but it was like, it's either on or it's off. We're either working together or we're not. She didn't say that to me, but there was something binary about it where I liked there being this sense of two speeds. Are we doing this or not? And what I learned in the past couple of years is sometimes I've done events in different countries or even in the US. And if I'm doing something with like an industry body that works at a much slower pace, I find it very hard to stay motivated and often feel like personally let down. Whereas when I work with an entrepreneur, it's like, okay, what are we going to do? What are we going to launch? When are we going to do it? Next Wednesday, go. And that's the energy that I personally love. And I'm saying that to you, I don't mean to patronize you, but you're just starting out. And I wasn't clear on these things until in the past few years. It took a few years of like, what do I want to be? What do I want to do? What are people responding to? So I'm curious as you progress if what I'm saying becomes more relatable or more part of how you might operate as well.
I relate to that because and this isn't a diss, it's just one of the frustrations I found over the years, and it's definitely true in big agencies, is sometimes client organizations are so complex that things take a long time. And perhaps justifiably so, perhaps sometimes it could be a bit leaner. But I do notice that my energy kind of dissipates in those circumstances. Blame it on probably mild ADHD. Blame it on needing some sort of relatively frequent validation. Because let's be honest, when we drop this deck, that feels validating to me for like a hot second. I go, yes, we dropped the thing. And then I go, what's my next thing now? But that could be an advantage. It may be a disadvantage. It's probably both. But it's a thing. It's a feature.
Is it a feature? Is it a flaw? Does it even matter? And over time, you're like, what do I want to honor? What do I want to pay attention to? We've done so much ranting and gossiping today. So let me end with the final piece of gossip. I've mentioned this one before. Former global head of new business from Leo Burnett, Bill Hickman, their New York office for a month before they closed it. I was there to run it as well. And then they were like, no, closing. Made sense because they moved Rockan, this digital agency, in, and I didn't want to move to Chicago. But one thing that he said to me is like, Aussies are sprinters, not marathon runners. That was him having worked 30 years in advertising in multiple parts of the world. And I was like, yep, like I can't slow down. And so when I started sort of doing strategy consulting and everything, I built it all around like to the word sprint is pretty tempting to use. I have used it, but I would work pretty quickly and I didn't seek long-term relationships. I just wanted to be in and out, try to contribute something high value, minimum required effort, MRE. How do you contribute high value with the least effort? That doesn't mean being lazy. It means being impactful because I had to honor it. And anytime I didn't, I would just get bored. And it's not that I started to hate myself. You know what I'm talking about? It's like, it doesn't feel natural to me. It's in the nature. So I think the lesson that I would want to pass on, I don't know why I'm being such a paternal figure, but the lesson I would want to pass on is over time you recognize features and flaws, and maybe the flaws are not flaws, they're your nature. And if they are, and if you deny those flaws, nothing too negative and evil, but if you deny them and it starts to hurt you, how do you honor them in the way that you build a business and a life as much as possible, which is a very privileged thing to say. Rob, it was fun working on this. Links in the show note. Let's chat in 5 years after you've gone through your first 5 years of stuff and see if any of these ideas connect. But I wish you all the best. I always love seeing your face. Good luck, mate.
Thanks for the chat and thanks for indulging my London mild public background noise. The most rewarding part of this process was actually when you went, right, it needs to be done in 48 hours. Because I think I'm kind of addicted to that rush of how much can we get done in a short period of time. That's probably the big thing, which ironically is a bit of a is focused on the idea of being small and a bit leaner. But I think strategists sometimes default to how much ground can we cover and how much time. And I'm almost going, how much ground can you cover in as little time as possible? And so that's why I am maybe a bit addicted to speed and to the frequency, but from my conversations with folks and client side, some people are taking a fucking long time to get to not very interesting results. So something needs to change.
But also as a strategist to end on this, simple, three categories, getting paid to think, being an entrepreneur who puts things into the world and has to survive off the stuff that they put into the world, and then being an entrepreneur based on your thinking. Very different modes, right? Because there's a strategist defense mechanism, which is to ask another question, another what if, to be intellectually interesting, or often in the guise of due diligence and being rigorous and thorough. But it's like, you know what? We got enough. Let's go publish next. And maybe there's a bit of a restaurant chef mentality that I think can be useful to the person who spent way too much time thinking.
Yeah, it's funny. I was having lunch with a friend today and we were talking a bit about this, which is there's an interesting shift that I imagine happens at some point where you go, yes, I'm a strategist, but that's not like strategist by trade, but that's not all I do. Like, for example, you're not only a strategist, you're a business person because you are in charge of this business staying afloat and thriving and paying back somehow and being fair to people and offering value to the market. There's just an element of over time, your identity becomes less of, oh yeah, my job is to say a lot of actually this, actually that, which by the way, I think is strategist's favorite word, actually, either that or reframe or fame. But over time, you just go, what's the role of this? Like, moment of truth, we look at this project we've done together and we go, there's value of what we're offering, but what's the payback? And the payback doesn't mean money. It may mean connection with others. It may mean we get to speak to people that otherwise we wouldn't have contact with. It may mean we seed some of this in other newsletters and that leads up to other opportunities. But it's partly for fun and it is fun. But the other part of it is like, what does this do for our respective businesses? And that is a level of pragmatism that I think sometimes we are too overprotected from. So we go, no, I just need to do fame and then other people will worry about the other stuff. And we go, no, we need to worry about all of it.
Awesome. Well, best wishes. I'll put a link in the show notes to the deck. It's called Stop Collaborating and Listen. The sections are, why do they force workshops on us? Dumb shit we say in workshops and how to work better with other humans. Hopefully I'll see you in London soon, my man.
Thanks, Mark.
Peace. Thank you for listening to this episode of Sweathead. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend, subscribe to our newsletter, find us on Instagram or LinkedIn at Sweathead. And if you're interested in finding out about our strategy memberships, company training, or books, visit sweathead.com. Whoop, whoop.